Adjustments. All of us are being asked to make big adjustments to our lives because of the coronavirus pandemic. With schools going all online, kids are suddenly being asked to work from home. Now, that's a tough adjustment for any kid, but for kids with autism, it can be especially difficult. We hear today from an expert on autism in children, and we'll talk about early intervention, managing behavior, and the new book series she's launching to help those kids and their parents. And we'll get an update on the COVID-19 situation here in western Wisconsin. That's all happening today on the West Side. Good morning. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and welcome to the West Side. We'll be joined in a few minutes by Kristen Wagner, a clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. However, we're going to start the show by talking about the COVID-19 pandemic with Elizabeth Domes-Harter. She's a digital content producer for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Eau Claire. And as always, your questions and comments are welcome. Call 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Liz Domes-Harter, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dean. I wish I could be in studio with you.
Yeah, we'll get there someday. Hey, as of yesterday, Wisconsin's Department of Health Services reports 52 cases of COVID-19 in West Central Wisconsin so far. No deaths reported in this part of the state yet. The number of cases has doubled from the past week, though, in our area. It still feels like the calm before the storm. Nationally, the pandemic is expected to peak in about 2 weeks. Liz, from what you've been able to find out, do we have any idea when that peak will hit those of us here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so, you know, early estimates were done from an analysis that was done by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation out of the University of Washington. And those early estimates said that the peak would happen in late May. But that all changed because more data was actually added into that model. So the peak date for Wisconsin, at least, was moved up to about April 27th. Now, that's actually also changed in the past few days. I think a couple days ago, it was April 26th. And experts are saying that it's a moving target because it all really depends on how well people conform to social distancing. Now, I want to let listeners know, too, that anyone can look at these models. They exist for all the states and the U.S. as a whole. So if you go to covid19.healthdata.org/projections, you'll be able to see that information. The IHME predicts that on April 27th, there's going to be a need for 376 ICU beds. There's 172 ICU beds available in the state, so that's going to leave a deficit of a few hundred. But from what we heard before in the newscast, you know, of how many cases there are here in Wisconsin, you know, more than 1,700. In western Wisconsin, we've seen, you know, Chippewa County has 11, Eau Claire has 14. There's just a handful in Trempealeau and Buffalo and Jackson. And there are some counties in the northern part of western Wisconsin that haven't seen any. But again, this is something that's being closely monitored. Our reporters are on media calls 3 times a week with DHS for constant updates to these numbers. And all of that information is available on WPR.org/COVID. All of our reporting, all of the information, we've got a map showing where these cases are, where the deaths are. Mostly they're right now concentrated in the Milwaukee and Madison areas, but that information is all available to folks.
Now, we've been in safer at-home mode in Wisconsin for a while now. I drove by Oakwood Mall in Eau Claire earlier this week, and there wasn't a single car in the parking lot. Very strange. How has the social distancing played out around here?
Isn't that just incredible to see? I know Governor Tony Evers directed DHS to issue that stay-at-home order on March 25th. That was the same day that non-essential services were closed. Education facilities closed about a week before that on March 18th. You know, we're seeing some people take this very seriously and really like staying home and only venturing out when absolutely necessary. But other people are taking a more lackadaisical approach. You know, schools are closed, but districts are doing what they can to serve their students. For example, the Eau Claire School District just instituted a student meals on yellow wheels program. That one started on Tuesday, and the goal there is to provide students who are 18 years of age and under with meals at 20 stops in different neighborhoods in Eau Claire. Churches are doing their best to stay connected with their communities through social media, especially through live streaming church services. But I think, you know, anecdotally, we're seeing families outside together, which is kind of neat. You know, we've been told to limit exposure to people not in our household. So we're seeing kids playing basketball with their parents in the driveway. And, you know, people are sitting on their porches and strumming on guitars and finding ways just to get outside. And then they're also relying heavily.
Liz, are you with us?
Oh, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
Sorry, you dropped out for a second.
You know, and so I'm not sure. People are relying a lot on digital services to connect with their friends and families. And software, which is Zoom, has seen just a skyrocket. We are finding ways to connect, you know, but it's still chaotic because...
Liz, we've got some trouble with your phone. I don't know if there's a better place you can go to get some better reception, but you're dropping out quite a bit.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's not your fault. It was as you were talking about the connections that your connection was starting to fall apart. So I think that you just said the wrong word or something like that. Liz, one exception to the safer at home is that we are allowed to go get groceries, for instance. You did a story Wednesday about the risk-benefit analysis of going to get groceries and making sure we're not bringing the virus home. What did you find?
Yeah, so this was an interview with Don Schaffner. He's a food science professor at Rutgers University, and he had a ton of great insight about this. But I think, you know, one of the most important tips that he said is that if you're elderly, you should not be going to the grocery store. So in this case, you know, have friends or neighbors or family members try and go get those groceries for you. And if you can't do that, maybe like contact a church and see if it's possible that someone there could get groceries for you. You know, that being said, Schaffner said that the chances of getting the virus from your groceries is slim to none. So you're going to get it from being around other people and not necessarily from touching food. So he gave up a couple of tips that were pretty useful. I think one of the things he said was, before you go to the store, make a list. That way, when you get to the store, you can move through the aisles much more efficiently. And then he said, look for hand sanitizer at the front of the store. A lot of stores are providing that. And that way you can clean your hands, you know, ahead of going into the store in case you're carrying anything on you. And then you can use that again when you leave the store just to ensure that you're killing anything that you might have picked up. Of course, you know, let's follow the rule of staying 6 feet away, at least 6 feet away from other people. You know, and he also talked about how we deal with groceries when we get home. So a lot of people have said that they're putting their groceries in the garage and just leaving them there for like a few days or a couple hours. He said that's really not a wise move, in part because we know the virus actually does pretty well in cold conditions. So if you're putting it in your garage, you know, in April weather, it's probably not going to do anything. And also, like, there's just a really slim chance that there is anything on those products. Now, if you just feel really unsafe about it and you want to, like, say, wipe down, you know, some of your groceries with, you know, Clorox wipes, that's fine to do. It's just not really necessary. If you're really concerned, I think the best thing that you can do is just wash your hands when you get home and then put your groceries away and then wash your hands again. And that will make sure that anything that you picked up is inactive.
So what's going on in the stores? What measures are the stores taking that are allowed to stay open in order to protect both shoppers and the workers?
Yeah. So, you know, some stores are providing whatever services they can online. For example, though, like Best Buy has established a curbside pickup so that, you know, customers don't actually have to go into the store at all. Menards recently announced that children who are under the age of 16 aren't allowed in the store at all, and anyone who looks like it will be asked to show a driver's license. Starting tomorrow, I just saw Target said it's going to monitor how many people are in the store and then limit the amount of customers if need be. You know, they're also hoping to supply their workers with disposable gloves and masks in the coming weeks. So, you know, we've also heard of businesses putting up like shields to protect their own employees and the customers. And we've also heard anecdotally of some stores taking temperatures of their employees.
You're listening to The West Side. We're speaking with Elizabeth Domes Harter. She is a digital content producer for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Eau Claire. Liz, another story you've been following has been the potential impact of COVID-19 disease on uninsured and underinsured Wisconsinites. Now, this pandemic has enough scary properties to cause anxiety without having to worry about how you're going to pay if you need to go to the hospital.
Yeah, boy, this is hard to swallow. You know, there were 300,000 people in Wisconsin who were uninsured, and thousands more who had basically unaffordable insurance even before the virus broke out. So there's a story that I did with Donna Friedsam. She's a researcher from the UW, and she said that the outbreak is really highlighting the flaws in our system. But she said there's some good news that, you know, health insurance plans said they'd waive fees for COVID-19 testing. And one of those, Ascension Wisconsin, announced it wouldn't bill uninsured patients for care related to COVID-19. But, you know, Friedsam said she wanted to see more of that happening, basically. One of the things that people should know is that losing a job does qualify you for special enrollment. So, you know, you can go to the Affordable Care Act marketplace and apply for that. Depending on your income, your premiums could be subsidized by the federal government. So that's, you know, important information to know. If people are really concerned, they can actually just call 211. They can, you know, folks there can get you connected with an enrollment assistant. But you should be aware that the lines are pretty busy now. So be patient with that as we move forward.
Yeah. Well, like many businesses, nonprofits in the area are hurting too. Yesterday, a group of nonprofits announced a new coalition called Together Chippewa Valley. What's that about?
Yeah, so this is the first of its kind fundraising coalition. It's bringing together nonprofits in Eau Claire and Chippewa counties, and the goal is to basically raise revenue to fund operation and programming costs, and to basically ensure that they can stay afloat amid this pandemic. So, you know, there are a couple groups involved so far, and that's the Boys and Girls Club of the Greater Chippewa Valley, Chippewa Valley Museum, the Children's Museum of Eau Claire, the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild, Eau Claire County Humane Association, the Family Resource Center, Junior Achievement of Wisconsin, and the Pablo Center. More nonprofits are expected to be invited to join, but if people want to donate to this, they can go to togetherchippewavalley.org and choose to make a gift. So then basically what will happen is those funds received will be divided equally among the nonprofits that are involved.
Now, most April weekdays, parents would be at work and kids would be in school. But in most families, those families are getting thrown together all day long. You've written pieces in the last week about this new phenomenon. How are parents and kids coping?
One of the things that really struck me in doing these articles is that younger children have attention spans of 10 to 15 minutes when they're doing a task. And I'm sure that doesn't come as a surprise to parents of toddlers out there. I don't have kids, so that was just really telling for me. But, you know, there's a reason that we can't all be stay-at-home, full-time working parents, right? So these challenges do exist. And I think, you know, one of the women, Lorena Mansla, excuse me, she's a childhood specialist at the UW, and she said that one of the things that parents should do right now is just be patient with themselves and be kind with themselves, because, like, we're all trying to figure this out together. So, like, if, you know, don't get frustrated by the fact that your kids aren't doing, you know, 4 hours of work every day. I mean, if you're going to do the best that you can, and that's what's important. But one of the really crucial pieces of information that she said was, you know, create a schedule. So, of course, like, a toddler's not going to be able to follow a schedule without guidance from you. But, like, what you can do is create something visual and something exciting for them, and maybe put it in a, you know, on the refrigerator or a place where they can see it. And then every day, take your child there and say, okay, this is the plan for the day. This is what we're going to do. And then make sure to point out things that are different from the day before. And that way, like, the kids can get excited about what they're going to do differently that day. She also said that try to pick, like, a corner or a space in the house where you can, like, dedicate that as their play and learn area. So This might be a good opportunity to get your kids and build a fort, like get a bunch of pillows and blankets and build a fort, and then just like put a bunch of their favorite toys in there, and then they kind of know, and of course, like make sure that this isn't an area where like you can see them, but then they know that that's the area where they can go to learn and play. And, you know, there's a ton of resources online. You know, PBS Wisconsin has a great assortment of programming. And then there's just a ton of websites that people can go to, you know, to provide like a learning infrastructure for their kids. And if you go to WPR.org, we have a list of a lot of those different resources. So that's a really good place to check out and learn from.
Another thing you can find on WPR.org is all the great writing that Elizabeth Domes Harder does. She's WPR's digital journalist based in Eau Claire. Liz, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Dean. It's a pleasure.
Now, for the rest of the hour, we talk about autism in children and resources available to parents here in Western Wisconsin. Your thoughts or questions on autism are welcome. Call 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and it's The West Side on the Ideas Network. We're back on The West Side, and for the remainder of the hour, our guest will be Dr. Kristen Wagner. She holds a master's degree in early childhood education and a PhD in clinical psychology. She's worked with young children with special needs for more than 30 years. She's the clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center, serving Western Wisconsin from its location in Altoona. Kristen Wagner, welcome to the West Side.
Good morning, Dean. Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to springboard from the end of our conversation with Elizabeth Domes Harder, who's been reporting for WPR, on the challenges of having kids at home when that wasn't part of the original plan. So what special challenges does that hold for parents of children with autism?
Oh, that's a great question. Children with autism struggle tremendously with changes in routine. So having this major change in routine that has been so difficult for all of us is just amplified for a child with autism. The children might be home from school, but they also might be missing therapies, occupational therapy, speech therapy, other activities. And so that change of routine of not going to the day-to-day activities is difficult. And then having two parents at home is something that maybe only happened on the weekends. And on the weekends, they would go to activities. Mm-hmm. And now they're home 7 days a week, and the outings aren't available. They can't go to the gym. They can't go to the library.
Well, not to mention that mom and dad might be working from home.
Oh, absolutely. That adds another obstacle that makes it extraordinarily difficult. And the resources that parents with children with autism have are not as available at home.
So April is Autism Awareness Month. What exactly is autism?
Autism is a developmental disorder that is developed in the first 3 years of life that affects a child's ability to interact socially with the people and the things in their environment, and also has what is called restricted repetitive behaviors. So a set of behaviors that a person might engage in, maybe similar to OCD, where it is a ritual or a compulsion where it interferes with the person's ability to interact with the people and the things in their environment.
Of course, every cause has its special month where it tries to build awareness for purposes of fundraising, but you say a key target for autism awareness has to be parents of young children.
Absolutely. We know right now the CDC's latest estimates are that autism affects 1 in 54 children. And being that autism is developed in the first 3 years of life, we also know that 80% of brain development happens in those first 3 years of life. And so while, of course, we can do intervention for children who are 4 or 5 or older, that early diagnosis is the most critical. There is empirical evidence that shows that the early intervention makes tremendous gains for children with autism. And so if we can get diagnosis early, we're able to start that intervention early and really help the child from an early age.
Our guest is Kristen Wagner, a clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. And we're talking about autism, particularly childhood autism. Now, it's been a long time since any of my kids were under two, but I can remember enough to know that I had trouble figuring out what to feed them that day, much less having the ability to diagnose autism. How does a parent know?
That's a great point. But you would not be, you just would not believe the number of parents that have come to me and sat across my desk and have said to me, I knew when my child was one. There is no handbook for parenting. There is, of course, checklist of developmental milestones, and often one of those developmental milestones is speaking, which is why so many family members and maybe teachers and maybe even pediatricians will say, oh, he's just a late talker or she's just a late talker, wait and see. But it's not, autism is not just about not talking. It's about the social reciprocity. And so from that early, even before 2 years old, at that 6 month, 9 month level, when you walked into your baby's room, your baby looked up to you and looked you in the eye and started to raise their arms to request to be picked up. They learned those anticipatory routines. And when you changed the diapers or when you were changing clothes, they participated in that back and forth baby play. Those are things that children with autism don't do. It's not just that they don't cuddle or they don't hug. It's that there is just this lack of participating in the back and forth social interactions. And so many parents, even those that come to me with children over the age of five who are getting the diagnosis for the first time will say, I knew this. My child needed more help, and nobody would listen to me. And so that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the Brody the Lion books that I wrote, and one of the reasons that we work so hard at getting the word out about autism is because if we can give parents the resources at age one, because we can diagnose autism at age one or age two. We can start that intervention, and we can help make new connections. We can teach that child to learn some of those foundational skills that they missed when they were 6 months old or 9 months old, and then the language follows. And so we don't want to wait for a child to not be talking at age three or not be talking at age four. We want to help the child when their brain is still developing these neural circuits. And beyond the social reciprocity, it's that rule-bound or the rigid and that repetitive behaviors that I spoke about earlier. Parents will notice that their child is covering their ears when they're making coffee, or maybe at their first birthday, they're singing happy birthday, and instead of looking at the people and enjoying the singing, the child is covering their ears and they're sensitive to these loud sounds, or they're becoming upset when the high chair is moved in a different place, or they switch from one sippy cup to another sippy cup. And so there's all kinds of red flags or warning signs that parents with children that are one and two realize.
If you have stories about childhood autism, and you know, let us know. We'd like to hear them. If you have questions or comments or thoughts, 800-228-5615, 800-228-5615, to join this conversation with Kristen Wagner, a clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. Dr. Wagner, how important are pediatricians in raising the possibility of autism in those young children?
Paramount. Most pediatricians will do what's called the childhood autism rating scale for children at 18 months. And if children show red flags or some warning signs when they're giving that screening test, those pediatricians will make the referral to one of the doctors that will do an autism diagnosis. The problem is that parents are phenomenal at knowing their own children. especially if you have a child that is maybe a bit temperamental or a child who is very sensitive. And so those parents that maybe have these concerns know what to do to help their child to not throw that tantrum and not have the meltdown in the pediatrician's office, because who wants to go to the doctor and have their child throwing a tantrum?
Sure.
And so often, even children that have autism, sometimes those pediatricians, I don't want to say often, but sometimes those pediatricians don't see the full meltdown because parents do their very best to make sure their child doesn't look like they have a behavior problem when they're at the doctor's office.
So what if you suspect your child has autism, but the doctors say, nothing to worry about?
Oh, that is such a great question. I just had a parent who has a 5-year-old that got diagnosed with autism, and she said to me, I thought it had to go through the doctor. I thought I had to have a doctor's referral. And you don't. You can call our office. You can call one of the other agencies that is on the resource list that I'm sure you will put up on your website, or contacting the Autism Society of Greater Wisconsin. And you can refer yourself and say, I have concerns that my child might be on the spectrum. I'd like to get an evaluation. And insurance companies, most insurance companies, do not require the doctor's prescription or a referral for the diagnosis. They do require, many insurance companies or Medicaid, Badger Care, require a doctor's prescription for therapy, but not for the diagnosis.
And we will put some resources up on the website when we post this show after late this morning or early afternoon. The Autism and Behavior Clinic in Altoona, where you work, promotes using applied behavior analysis, or ABA, to reduce the child's negative behaviors and teach new ones. Talk about how that works.
That's a loaded question. ABA, applied behavior analysis, is the gold standard when it comes to working with children with autism. And it is the reason that we have funding for autism at the level that we have. Dr. Ivar Lovis out of UCLA in California in the 1960s did one of the first studies that showed that if you systematically work with children using ABA, applied behavior analysis, you can make dramatic gains. And Dr. Lovas did long-term studies and followed children that received this therapy into their elementary school years and into adulthood. And his research studies that have been replicated across the country and across the globe showed that the level of services that a child needed in elementary school, the special education services, and then the adult services were dramatically decreased for the children that received what was called intensive therapy. And that has ranged over the years between 10 hours, 20 hours. At this point, intensive therapy is 30 to 40 hours a week of one-to-one ABA therapy. And ABA itself sometimes has a bad name, and that really is a misnomer, because it's more than just sitting at a table and saying, what is this, and then having the child answer and then rewarding with an M&M. At our clinic, for example, we don't use food as reinforcers, which is sometimes what people think about when they hear of ABA. Some people equate it to like training a pet, where you're going to say sit, and then the child sits, and then you again reinforce them with some sort of candy or a treat or a tangible, a physical reinforcer. And that's maybe experimentally how ABA started when it was in the laboratory and maybe early on, but most behavioral analysis companies and providers have grown, and now we provide a type of therapy that is very child-centered and is focusing not just on teaching the acquisition of skills, but really on focusing on each child's areas of need. And so we're looking at how does autism affect that child and how can we help that child overcome the barriers and the obstacles that are preventing them from learning. So if it is that the child is not interacting socially or is not communicating with gestures, we're going to focus on that aspect. And so when we start, especially when we start with a 18-month-old or with a 2-year-old, we're not sitting at a table and saying, what is this? What is this? As I spoke before, what we're trying to focus on is those foundational skills. And so we're going to work with the child, of course, reinforcing. And so the basics of ABA is that we're going to use positive reinforcement to increase the behaviors that we want while decreasing the behaviors that we don't want. But we don't have to do that by sitting at a table and handing out candy. I can reinforce the behaviors I want by praising and cheering. And if you watch any of my videos or see me at the clinic, I am a very wild and crazy. We're very loud here because we're building all of that social interactions and the fun. And it has to get broken down to its extraordinarily smallest step, because if that child didn't know how to pay attention to you when you were singing Itsy Bitsy Spider, when you were singing Wheels on the Bus, or you didn't realize that they needed to lift their hand to put, you know, their arm into the shirt, we break skills down into their smallest component, and then we do reinforce every small skill, and we do that in a way that is socially reinforcing, which then helps also to build that social element that is missing.
So you mentioned 30 to 40 hours a week. I assume some of that is mom and dad working with the child at home then.
That's on top of mom and dad working home is on top of the 30 hours, right. And each company operates a little different. There's two levels of intervention. There is this comprehensive or the intensive level that is 30 to 40 hours a week. The bulk of those hours are provided by what's called a behavior technician, and that's primarily going to be a university student or maybe somebody with a bachelor's degree in education or human services. And most companies provide that service in the family home. And so that therapist, that behavior technician is going into that child's home or their daycare or the community, working one-to-one with that child and, of course, with the family and the caregivers, but providing that therapy. And it sounds like it is an extraordinary number of hours. And often people have the same reaction that you just had, like, oh, my gosh, you want, you know, my child, you know, is 2 years old and you want them to do 40 hours a week. But I don't like to use the word neurotypical because in the autism community, there is many advocates that like to talk about being neurodiverse and celebrating autism. And so I'm trying to change my own vocabulary. But in the past, we've called people with autism and then people that are neurotypical. And what is typical? I don't know that, you know, either me or you are typical. Yeah. So somebody without autism, as they're developing, that child is going to play with the toys and explore and learn from interacting with those toys. The child with autism, that child might only be staring at a reflection of a TV screen or looking at a reflection in a mirror or looking at their hands flapping or lining up their cars or repetitively dumping out objects and then putting them back in and dumping out. And they get stuck on that repetitive behavior. And without intensive intervention, they're missing all of those opportunities that a child that is developing without autism is getting aha moments. They're building new neural synapses in their brains, and they're making connections. And so as they're playing, even without the adult facilitation, a child without autism is making connections, you know, hundreds and thousands of connections on a daily basis. And so that child with autism needs that one-to-one intervention to help them to pay attention to the salient aspects, the important aspects in the environment. And so what is the car doing? Instead of just taking the car and spinning the wheels.
Kristen Wagner is the clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. She's also the author of a new book, and a children's book, but it's also for parents about autism. And we'll talk about the Brody the Lion series that she's developed. coming up after our break. Is there a person with autism in your life? We'd like to hear your story as well as your questions, thoughts, or comments. 800-228-5615, 800-228-5615 to share your story. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and you're listening to The West Side on the Ideas Network. We're back on the West Side, and I'm with Kristen Wagner. She is clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. She's also an author. She's written a book about Brody the Lion. So, Kristen Wagner, what inspired your decision to write a book?
I think the biggest reason that I decided to write this series is that my career has focused on trying to help as many children and families as I can. And it feels like I just can't reach enough families. And so often hear parents that come in and say, I wish I had met you when my child was one or when my child was two, or I wish I had known about this therapy that was an option. I wish somebody would have listened to me. And so my goal is to provide parents a platform to empower them, to give resources, to help the parents and families know that they are not alone and they're not doing something wrong. When a child is having a meltdown in a shopping center, or they're, you know, I think we've all experienced with our children when they won't go to bed at night, or they don't want to get in the bath, or they don't want to get out of the bath, or they, you know, throw their tantrum when they're saying no. We all experience those meltdowns and those tantrums when children aren't getting their way. But for the parent of a child with autism to be looked at like they're bad parents because their child is having the meltdown after meltdown after meltdown, I just wanted to give families a platform to be able to know that they're not alone and start with some tools. And so the books themselves are a typical child story, 3 to 5 year old little preschool story that outlines a challenge or an obstacle that a child with autism faces, but also a obstacle or a challenge that all children face. And then at the end of the books, there is first teaching tips or strategies on how you can read the story to your child. If your child is nonverbal, we read books in a different way than we do if we're reading the book to a child who has single words.
Well, how would that work?
How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, what would the difference be? I'm curious.
Right. So, it's so different because even a child that's developing as we would expect them to, the literacy literature and pre-reading tells us that we want to teach them so much vocabulary and we want to read the words. But for a child with autism, when we read books the way that they are written, if the child doesn't have that ability to understand the language the way I envision it, it sounds just like that Charlie Brown teacher voice, a wah, 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 wah. And you can see it when I'm reading that story to this two-year-old with autism and they don't understand the word, all of a sudden their eyes turn away from the page. They start staring at the light. They might start flicking their fingers. Or if the child is verbal, they might start talking about one of their preferred interests or, you know, shifting the story. And it might not be any different for a child with ADHD or maybe a different child that has a short attention span. And so what we want to do is we want to make sure that we're not just absently reading the book. We want to read that story so that the child is actively engaged and has a role. So as I'm reading the story to a two-year-old that is pre-verbal or nonverbal, I am going to completely alter the text. And so on our website, on Brody the Lion website and on YouTube, there'll be videos of me reading the story to that two-year-old and to a three-year-old and a four-year-old and a child that's verbal and a child that's nonverbal. And so as I'm reading it to the nonverbal child, I'm not reading the text as written. And so the text might say that, you know, Brody the Lion was as proud as could be. His birthday was coming. He was going to be three. Again, that's going to sound like wah, 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 wah to that child with autism. And so first I'm going to show the pictures, and Alex Garcia, my illustrator, is a phenomenal illustrator who has been able to capture emotions so tremendously. And so she is, pictures on these books are going to be just wonderful, and we can see Brody's expression, and we can see the expressions of his friends. And so we look at the page with the child, and then I might say, you know, where's cake? And we're going to just look at the cake, and we're going to talk about the pictures as opposed to actually trying to tell the story. Because if the child doesn't have the representational understanding of a birthday, which is what the first book is about, then the words aren't going to make sense to that child.
Tell us more about that first book. It's due out next month, I understand.
It is, yeah, hopefully with production,
yeah.
If things go well.
Nothing's normal right now.
But, exactly, yeah. Right. Well, for sure it will at least be available on the Kindle version on Amazon if we don't get it produced out in the paper format. But the first book is about Brody's birthday. So he is going to have a birthday, and he invites his friends.
And Brody's a lion.
Brody is a lion, yeah. a cartoon character lion, and so he's waiting for his friends to come, and he wanted his friends to come at 9 o'clock, and then in the book you see it's 9:05 and an empty street. The friends have not arrived, and so Brody roars his big roar, and then the next page has either the mom or the dad saying, "Brody, you know what to do. Let's take a deep breath and count to two." And practicing mindfulness and deep breathing and teaching children to regulate their behaviors when things go awry, when there is a change in routine, when somebody is late, when later in the book Brody doesn't get the present that he was expecting to get, or it's too loud when the friends sing happy birthday. All of those obstacles that can cause a meltdown, and in the story Brody roars his big roar, and then his mom and dad help him by taking that deep breath and practicing calming down.
And then you expect, what other topics do you plan? You say this is the beginning of a series. What other sorts of challenges will you be dealing with?
So we have, I think, topics that most parents, certainly parents with children with autism, but I think most parents of toddlers and preschoolers can appreciate. We have taking the bath, getting a haircut, going shopping, which can certainly pose many, well, challenges certainly today, but pose challenges. We have losing, not wanting to share, going to bed, so a variety of those everyday topics. So it's not just for children with autism. The children without autism, I think, and parents of children without autism will benefit equally.
One point that's really been emphasized in recent years is that autism is a spectrum. Some people with autism have high IQs, and they can do well academically. There's a popular network TV show featuring a physician with autism, for example. Does high intelligence impact the ability to diagnose autism in young children?
Well, that's a great question. I think it absolutely does. I think the children that come to me at those older ages that I spoke of, the 4-year-olds, the 5-year-olds, or even school-age children, one of the reasons that those children were not diagnosed younger was because they didn't have those same legs in the developmental milestones. So they walked on time, they talked on time, they maybe even talked earlier. And so those children, they hit those developmental milestones, and so when the pediatrician was doing the checklist, they didn't have those same concerns, or maybe the parent didn't even bring up the concerns because their child's vocabulary was advanced. So unlike what I was talking about before with a 2-year-old that doesn't have the vocabulary, some 3-year-olds with autism, maybe undiagnosed, have a vocabulary that is far beyond their age. And so that definitely interferes with the diagnosis being made. And in years past, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we had the diagnosis of Asperger's. And so there was in the DSM-4, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that we use for diagnosing autism, there were multiple conditions under that autism umbrella, Asperger's being one of them, which was given to children who had the deficits of autism but did not have a language delay and had average to above average IQ. And one of the reasons that that diagnosis was eliminated, and in the DSM-5, again, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that we currently use, autism is just considered one umbrella, one spectrum disorder. And that Asperger's diagnosis was removed because the research study showed us that long-term outcomes were not any better for children with higher IQs than they were for lower IQs, because it's not about a person's intelligence or their IQ that projects somebody's ability to be successful in life. You can work at a grocery store or at a as a mechanic, or you can be a physician. The skill is irrelevant. We all, in every profession that we do, must interact with people. Even if you work alone, you still have to know how to communicate with people and interact with people and tolerate all of the changes and disruptions that happen. I think that the past 4 weeks, for all of us, we get a tiny little glimpse of what it must be like for a child with autism or an adult with autism to have this disruption in our lives and that feeling of uncertainty and not knowing where we're going from day to day.
About a minute left, and this is a big question, I know, but do your best to boil down your thoughts on it. You mentioned earlier this concept of neurodiversity. There are arguments out there that we shouldn't try to change the personality traits of individuals who have autism, the concept of neurodiversity. Is the early intervention you're talking about changing these kids from who they were meant to be?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. And no. And that is something that I say. I would never want to change a person's personality. I don't want to change who they are. Every single person, every child that comes to me is a unique, wonderful human being that brings just unbelievable amounts of joy and affect. What I want to do is I want to help that child reach his or her potential, not change who they are. But I would like them to not have to struggle. I would like them not to have to put headphones on to be able to go to the grocery store unless they choose to do that because they want to. But I don't want them not going to a birthday party because they're afraid somebody's going to sing, or not applying for a job because they're worried about the lights being too bright. And so I want to be able to teach children how to embrace who they are as human beings, but not have the meltdowns that prevent them from being successful.
Kristen Wagner is clinical psychologist at the Autism and Behavior Center in Altoona. She's left us some links to resources for people wondering about autism here in Western Wisconsin, and we appreciate that. We'll put them on our website when we post this show. She's the author of the soon-to-be-released book, Sometimes I Roar. Dr. Wagner, thank you so much for joining us.
Dean, thank you so much for having me and to provide this opportunity to put a spotlight on autism awareness.
Kate Spranger is our on-air producer and publicist for today's show. We also want to thank WPR journalist Elizabeth Domes-Harder for joining us earlier in the hour for our update on the COVID-19 pandemic's effect in Western Wisconsin. We'll get another update on the effect next week, and we'll also look into President Trump's announced plans to expand deportations of undocumented Hmong residents to Laos. We'll get a response from the local Hmong community. I'm Dean Kallenbach. You're listening to The West Side.